This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak with Robert Lanza, MD, who's the Vice President of Medical and Scientific Development at Advanced Cell Technology in Massachusetts. Welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you.
I also want to say congratulations on what's apparently a big breakthrough here in creating retinal stem cells that can be used to treat a variety, or will eventually be able to be used to treat a variety of eye diseases. What exactly did you announce yesterday?
Well, what we've actually done for the first time is to actually generate what are known as retinal pigment epithelium from embryonic stem cells. Now, these are the cells that support the photoreceptors, the cones and rods that we use to see with. And this is extremely important because these cells could be used to treat literally millions of patients who potentially could go blind in the future. For instance, macular degeneration, this affects over 30 million people worldwide. And so that's one important finding here. And the second is these cells, we believe, could be one of the very first applications of embryonic stem cell technology.
Okay, where did you get your embryonic stem cells?
Well, we actually studied 11 embryonic stem cell lines. Six of these were derived with private funding at the Howard Hughes Foundation at Harvard University and the laboratory of Doug Melton.
Right.
And those we found readily turned into these cells very easily. I
read in some of the literature here that's because retinal cells are kind of like nerve cells, and stem cells gravitate to become nerve cells more easily than any other type.
Yes, that's exactly true. It turns out that these embryonic stem cells like to become neuronal. So that's one of the reasons why those embryonic stem cell lines have been so difficult to turn into other cell types.
Right.
We have been able to turn them into all virtually all the cell types of the body, but what's very important for therapy is to create them in sufficient number and in of sufficient purity to be of therapeutic value. And what we've done here is we've created a system that allows us to reliably generate large numbers of these cells with very high purity, and in fact, using gene analysis, we're able to show that they very closely resemble the body's normal retinal cells. We also were able to do various biochemical studies, marker studies, that show that they express all of the proteins that they should, and that they carry out the actual functions that we would hope they would.
Now, when you started this project, did you had a target a cell, namely the ones that are there normally now, and how did you get from the embryonic stem cell to the epithelial cell that you just said you've been able to create an almost exact replica of?
Right. Well, as you alluded to earlier, the embryonic stem cells do like to become, they have a mind of their own and like to become neuronal type cells. So this is almost a default pathway. So we found that with very little coaxing that they readily turned into these pigmented epithelial cells. And by just slightly modifying our culture conditions and plating them out on these gelatin plates so that we didn't need to expose them to animal cells, we were able to very reliably passage them using techniques that we developed over the last year or so. And they, like I said, these cells wanted to do this, and they did it very easily with very little effort. And I think by identifying the cells and passaging them using techniques that we've worked out, we can do this very reliably. And as a matter of fact, all of the stem cell lines we studied from Harvard and the two lines that we studied here at ACT did this very easily. Unfortunately, the three lines that we studied that were approved by President Bush, the so-called NIH registered lines, they proved more problematic. Once we had the conditions identified for producing these, even knowing that and with heroic efforts, they still were very reluctant to turn into these cell types. We have succeeded at doing it, but again, not only were they difficult to turn into the cell types, but we had a very hard time getting them to grow and passage in sufficient numbers to be of therapeutic value.
So the Harvard Hughes cells were better than the Bush cells.
Yes, absolutely. But again, the Howard Hughes lines, were developed using more current techniques. They also maybe earlier passage. That means that they're younger. so that it could be that not only are they younger, but also as a result they're also more robust and easier to manage.
Right. Now this term of art you're using here, passaging, mm-hmm. that's essentially the term that you use to mean transformation from a primordial stem cell into a useful particular cell.
Well, by passaging we mean growing, essentially. What you do is you grow these cells in a petri dish until they become confluent, until they've filled up the dish.
Right.
And then what you do is you have to then remove them from the dish and seed them out at a lower density, and that's
right.
called passaging. So this is very important because, yes, many different cell types have been identified, you know, to have been derived from embryonic stem cells, but the problem is you can't reliably grow them or grow them in a way that's controlled. So say, for instance, if I were to look at in a petri dish that contains embryonic stem cells, I may see some beating hot cells over on this part of the dish. I may see some hair follicles over here. I may see some cartilage cells or some muscle cells. They tend to differentiate into a hodgepodge of cell types.
Right.
So again,
yeah, as they do when they become the body, essentially, right? When
exactly. That's exactly it. They start to interact with one another, and one type of tissue interacts with another, and then they actually start doing all sorts of, like I said, very fascinating things. Like I said,
right.
you'll see a whole dish of beating hot cells, for instance.
Right. So the challenge for you and your competitors then is to develop those processes that will allow you to take what are apparently homogeneous collection of the stem cells at the beginning and make sure they all turn into epithelial retinal cells, or they all turn into nerve cells, or they all turn into muscle cells, right? So you get what you're looking for.
Yes, and that's correct. And in addition to this, of course, you know, it's very, very important to find out that those cells actually are have the properties and characteristics of the cells that you want.
Right.
So that you may have, say, a muscle cell, but, you know, is this, say, for instance, a hot cell, a smooth muscle cell,
right.
or et cetera. And in this particular case, these retinal pigment epithelial cells have very specific characteristics, and we used in this study something known as transcriptomics, again using gene analysis of all the hundreds of thousands of genes, and it turns out that the exact genes that they have that are turned on very, very closely resemble the body's natural cells. In fact, they more closely resembled the cells that we're looking for than the existing retinal cell lines that have actually been used in animals to attenuate visual loss.
So in fact they're better than the previous one.
Certainly by the assessments that we've carried out, they appear to be.
And you have a system in place now that would allow you to produce unlimited quantities of these cells?
Right. We're up to what we would call population doublings. Every time a cell divides, it's a population doubling, and we're over 30 population doublings, and that's a very, very large number, millions and millions of cells, and it's still continuing to grow.
You just said that the Harvard or Hughes cells were younger, more vigorous than the more attenuated Bush cells. Is that a danger or a worry or a problem for you that after more doublings and more doublings, they're going to lose their potency?
Well, we're talking about two different things here. One is embryonic stem cell lines are immortal. They
right.
continue to grow. What we're talking about here is having a differentiated cell that has therapeutic value, and we want to expand those into sufficient numbers. So we're no longer talking about embryonic stem cells at that point. Once we've turned the embryonic stem cell into these retinal cells, then you want to grow those cells up, and once they become a differentiated cell, they become finite. That means they start to undergo a certain number of doublings, and that's pretty normal. That's what all of our body cells do.
But not an infinite number of doublings.
Not an infinite number, but these still could be considered quite youthful relative to the natural lifespan of the cell.
So the primordial stem cells become the retinal cells, and those are then replicated many times to produce the therapeutic agents that you're going to use.
Exactly.
All right. Timing. You've got this now. How long until clinical? Are you going to move to clinical tests? And what's the timetable for all that?
Well, again, this very much depends on the resources we have available. You know, I know I may seem a bit optimistic here, but I believe with the right resources, we could be in clinical trials within 2 years. I think that these cells look extremely promising. We already have approval and have some of these animal preclinical studies underway. So assuming they go well, I would think we would be able to also be running safety studies concurrently, so that I think there's a very real chance, if things go the way we hope, that we could be ready for clinical trials within 2 years.
Have you done animal trials yet?
We have the approval. They're underway. We have the cells ready, and they're imminent.
Do you know for sure with a certain degree of certainty that you have the techniques to apply these into the retinas?
These are existing. There are already animal models in place, natural and artificial models, in rodents, rabbits, and other animal models that already are used to study these various diseases. So these are in place. These have been well developed and characterized, and so there are numerous groups that have been working with these models for years.
With these models and with human tests, are these cells injected into the blood? Are they injected into the retina? How's that done?
Yeah, there are a number of approaches. One of the main approaches would be, for instance, that you would put them on little discs and they would be placed in the back of the eye in the subretinal space. So that would be the first approach. That's the approach that is used by many groups.
Through surgery?
Yes.
And that's done now, you're saying, from with the problems, of course, being that they're not as good as yours and that there may be rejection issues.
Well, there are a number of issues here. One, of course, as you point out rightly, that it turns out rejection is profoundly important here.
Right.
So if you were to inject adult cells, we know that they will reject readily, even though the eye is an immune-privileged site.
Adult cells, you mean cells generated from adult stem cells? Or retinal epithelial cells?
Yeah, just adult retinal epithelial cells.
From somebody other than the person where they came from.
Exactly. And those do readily reject. Then there are also the fetal RPE cells.
Right.
That's what is used most often. And those reject less so. So there are actually some patients that have these that have shown profound improvement. And we still don't quite understand. Some of those do seem to be accepting the cells. Again, the eye is an immune privileged site. But in other instances, they do reject. So the hope here would be, one, that the embryonic cells would be even less immunogenic, and two is using these other technologies such as nuclear transfer or parthenogenesis, we may be able to create lines that match the patient precisely.
Okay, let me take those two. The idea being that if they're stem cell derived, they're likely to be less antagonistic, elicit less rejection, right?
Right. It seems the more primitive they are, the further back you go, the less immunogenic they are.
Okay. And then the second part, which is...
And they may, in fact, be special.
The parthenogenic solution is essentially that you take a cell from the patient and use it to activate a denucleated egg cell and create a new stem cell line that's particularly tailored to that individual, and if you generated the stem cells and then the retinal epithelial cells, you could inject them and there'd be no reaction in the rejection side because it's the same genome, it's the same.
Well,
is that the idea?
Close. There's two processes. One is the nuclear transfer, which is also often known as therapeutic cloning. That means you would take an egg, enucleate it, and then put the patient's cell in and create a line that would be specifically custom for that patient. So it would be
right.
The patient's own cells. The parthenogenesis is slightly different.
Oh,
what you would do is you would just take an egg and fool it into thinking it was fertilized, and you'd create something known as a parthenode, a microscopic ball of cells. And the unique thing there is that all the genes are maternal. They're just one set of genes. So scientifically, we call that homozygous. And what that does is it considerably reduces the complexity of the molecules that cause rejection, so that with maybe 40 or certainly less than perhaps 400 lines, we could create a bank that would match most of the United States population. By contrast, if you didn't use this so-called parthenogenesis, you would then require hundreds of thousands of lines. So that we believe that with a small number of lines created through that process, we could establish a bank of cells that could be used, like I said, to match most of the population in the United States.
So you're saying the categories of rejection processes are only about 400 different categories of those?
Well, there are a few more than that, but what it turns out, is that by reducing the complexity of the genes, it's much easier to get a match for a patient.
And you'd be equally able to get, in this particular instance, we're talking about retinal epithelial cells, from these parthenogenically generated
cells. We believe so. We did generate these cells and from primates created that way. Okay. So, I mean, you know, the studies need to be done, but there's no reason to believe that they will act any differently. Our studies using animal cells derived through the various methods suggest there isn't very much difference.
And if this were done with a patient's adult cell, adult nucleus that was put into an egg,
mm-hmm.
Then the stem cells and the specific cells that were generated from that would all be muscle cells, nerve cells, retinal cells, would all be able to run under the radar of or avoid the problem of rejection.
Absolutely. They'd be genetically identical to the patient.
So there'll be two approaches. One is to have give someone one of the 400 types of parthenogenically generated stem cell generated cells.
Right,
the
other one is already available.
Already available off the shelf at that point, versus having a customized process by which adult somatic cell transfer is used to create their own line.
Right, and that would have to be done for every patient.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if you have, you know, in the case of, say, you know, in this instance, macular degeneration, you know, you're talking millions of people. And that, you know, obviously would require a very large number of eggs.
Right.
It would require a considerable amount of effort. And, you know, again, there's a, you know, timing for other diseases. Say, you know, say, for instance, you wanted to do the same process for, say, someone who had a heart attack. You know, certainly that would, it would take many, many months to not only generate the embryonic stem cells, but also then you have to turn them in to the cell types you want. And in this case, this is a process that takes time. So that could be problematic. So, like, we did a study that we published just a few months ago where we actually used cloned stem cells that we injected into mice that had heart attacks, very severe heart attacks, 60%. And within 4 weeks, we had restored 40% of the damaged tissue. But the key there is to get those cells in right after the heart attack, immediately after the heart attack. You don't have half a year, that luxury of half a year to wait.
So that means you have to use the parthenogenic off-the-shelf technique.
In that instance. You know, certainly you could use them later, but, you know, you've missed an important window of opportunity.
Two questions about numbers. Do you have any idea, let's say everything works out great, it's 3 to 5 years from now, how much either the parthenogenic-based or the individual-based approach is going to cost?
Obviously, there would be, you know, considerable differences here. I mean,
right.
If you had a generic cell line, they, you know, grow extensively, or embryonic stem cell lines, which are immortalized and grow indefinitely. I think that, you know, you're talking about something that would be considerably less expensive because you don't need to characterize every single batch of cells.
Right.
You know, I'd be hard pressed to give you a number, but, you know, the number, of course, is going to drop very considerably the more people that this is applied to.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if you had just, you know, one or two patients, this could be quite expensive. If it's applied to very large numbers of patients, it would drop proportionally.
Now, would you be able to generate the necessary cells for large amounts of patients from a few eggs, or are you going to need a lot of eggs
through
the parthenogenic method,
or the
other method either?
Yeah, this is important. Once you have a bank of embryonic stem cells, those cells can be used for virtually all patients who need all the therapies for stem cells. In other words, you have an undifferentiated cell that's immortal that can continue to divide indefinitely, and you now have those cells in your bank. And then what you can do is, for instance, do, say, the procedure we have. We could take a few of those cells and start growing the retinal cells and have those frozen away, you know, which we have done, and they freeze and thaw very readily, and have them ready. But at the same time, say you had heart disease and we wanted to turn these into c-Kit positive cells or hematopoietic cells, we could have those ready. But the thing is that you have a stem cell that has, you know, a very, very long or unlimited lifespan, so that those can be used for everybody, for all disease types that you may be able to apply this technology to.
Okay, so it's like banking a lot of potatoes in the cellar and taking them out to make them fried, mashed, or
And being able to just keep, you know, sort of, I guess this is a terrible analogy. What was it in the Bible where, you know, Jesus broke the bread and it just kept breaking it and breaking it and it keeps feeding, you know, indefinitely? Well, that's what a stem cell is like. You can use up cells, but yet the original cells you started from will continue to divide and replenish the ones you use.
Okay.
And that's the beauty of this technology.
Okay. Now, what about the eggs? Is it going to be necessary? Will 400 parthenogenically stimulated eggs be enough to generate, say, for all the types, or
It depends on whose numbers you're looking at.
Right.
I've heard estimates, depending on how you're doing the arithmetic, down to just a few dozen lines, and then I've heard numbers as high as, 700.
Right.
I think most of the numbers that, the experts that I've spoken with, would say it's somewhere, in the range of 40 to 400. But again, you gotta be careful. That's for the majority of the population. I don't want to give you a number, if it's, 50, 60, 70%. What's going to be more problematic is that unfortunate 20, 25% of the population, they're going to be more difficult. So, you may be able to hit the majority of the population using this technology, but to hit the remaining smaller fraction will require a considerably larger number.
Okay. This is all fascinating. It's all important. It all ties into what's happening here in California, which is what I want to address next.
Mm-hmm.
You said that the retinal epithelial cell line is ready to go if you get the resources. You have a dollar figure on that, what the resources for the clinical tests that will be necessary to get it FDA approved will run to?
Well, there are many different steps here. We're at a very early phase, and obviously we're talking about preclinical studies, and I would hate to throw a number out in the public,
right.
But they're not large numbers. So clearly that work, I believe, could be done with a reasonable cost.
It wouldn't take $3 billion, for example.
No, that wouldn't.
Okay.
But again, to get something into the clinic is a far more expensive proposition. And, but at the point that you've successfully carried out your preclinical trials, then you could get a pharmaceutical company or some other entity that is traditionally, getting this into for three or four clinical trials to cover those expenses.
Right.
But
now,
what we're talking about, our concern here today, is essentially that the amount of research going now to get these, this technology into the clinic is minimal. It's just a tiny amount of money. And this proposition would essentially make California, the stem cell center of the world. I mean, you would have more money here and the resources. This would jumpstart this technology, and you would effectively monopolize the entire field.
Well,
I mean, because that's a huge amount of money.
Now, you think that's a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, if you're gonna, I just had a gentleman come into my office this morning who has a son that was 15, and I guess the relatives have going blind at 18. Now, for him, it's the difference between he'll be blind in 3 years or 4 years,
right.
Or waiting a few extra years. Of course, it's a good idea. You're talking about literally 3,000 Americans die every day from diseases that could be treated using this technology in the future. That's a lot of people. And, every day we wait and postpone the research means it's going to have its toll in real people who die and who become blind and have limbs amputated from diabetes. I think we've sat on this far too long. We should already be in the clinic with this technology. And I think the time has come, for somebody, to put the resources in to try to help get this in the clinic so people can be helped.
Okay, now let me ask you this. You're a privately held company. You have
mm-hmm.
investors' money that finance what you do. You've worked with these privately funded sort of NGO
mm-hmm.
funded cell lines from Harvard Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
You've been able to do this without signing up for part of the $3 billion that Proposition 71 would put forward. And would you have been able to do it any faster or any more effectively?
Well, this is a good example.
Had access to this money?
This work would not have been possible without access to these private lines.
Right.
Now, Doug Melton at Harvard has these lines. He will make them freely available to any researcher that would want them.
Right.
It's just unfortunate that no one can work with them because they don't have the resources. Now, I'm not familiar exactly with the details of this bill, but I would suppose that the funding would be available to use these new robust lines that have been generated at Harvard. If that's the case, this is extremely important because, again, like I said, this discovery would not have been made if we had been restricted to the NIH-approved lines. And this is important because what this will mean now is that researchers, the entire biomedical and creative talent of the entire state of California will now be able to use these lines unrestricted.
Okay, two points. The without going into the voluminous details of the legislation,
mm-hmm.
it enshrines in the California Constitution a legal right to do somatic cell nuclear
yep.
transfer.
Mm-hmm.
which I think is another way of saying embryonic stem cell research. Is it?
Well, it's basically another word, which a lot of people don't like to use, therapeutic cloning.
Right.
So that's not embryonic stem cell research per se. Embryonic stem cell research can proceed without that. The nuclear transfer is the way to solve the problem of immune rejection.
Right.
So we you know, they're related, but they're not the same thing.
Is there any difference, biologically speaking, scientifically speaking, between therapeutic cloning and reproductive cloning?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think everybody in the scientific community, I don't think there's a reputable scientist alive who thinks that it's ethical or safe to proceed with reproductive cloning. The goal of reproductive cloning is to produce an identical copy of a child.
Right.
That's a whole entirely different, you know, most people find that abhorrent. On the other hand, what we're talking about for the nuclear transfer for research purposes is to create a microscopic ball of cells in a petri dish, cells that are undifferentiated. You know, these entities that we're creating, you know, are, like I said, it's all done in the laboratory. So that's a whole different goal.
If you had two scientists doing, one of them was doing reproductive cloning, one of them was doing therapeutic cloning, they would follow the exact same steps to the point where they had the blastocyst, wouldn't they?
Exactly, the pre-implantation embryo.
I'm sorry?
The pre-implantation embryo,
That's the same thing. So they could, one of them say, oh, I'm doing reproductive, I'm going to take it and put it in a uterus. The other one says, I'm going to do therapeutic cloning, I'm going to go break it open, take out the cell mass and turn it into stem cells, right? But up to that point, they've been doing the same thing, haven't they? Up until that point?
Well, at the very first stages are similar, yes.
Right, okay.
But the difference being, of course, you know, that, you know, this is why we have laws. You don't outlaw, you know, make millions of innocent patients suffer because there may be one or two bad apples. That's why you have laws. And I certainly don't think that anyone would be willing to face, you know, 10 years imprisonment and $1 million fine. I think that they would find another place that more appropriate to do this work. So I think, you know, what you're talking about here, and they're two totally different goals.
Right.
To create stem cells is certainly will be, my guess would be, is it would be a lot easier than, you know, somebody who may want to abuse this technology. But I would be very, very surprised, shocked, if anyone would risk the penalties associated with doing reproductive cloning there. They could go to other places where they could do it without any problem.
Okay, and in fact, whatever advances are made in the overall technology here through Proposition 71 activities would only be a small part of what would be necessary to do reproductive cloning. In other words, it's the first 1% of the process. Or is it? In other words, how much of the reproductive cloning process is subsumed within the therapeutic cloning process? In other words, would this research be of any use, not that someone would necessarily do it under the legal circumstances you've just described, but how much knowledge would be gained that would be useful in doing reproductive cloning through the study?
Well, I think it's really almost a moot issue, because the point is in the next few years, you know, the procedures and protocols for this are going to be readily available everywhere in the world.
Right.
And so what you're talking about here really is whether or not you're just simply going to hold back helping people who are dying of diseases from benefiting from this. So
okay.
You're not going to stop that. That's going to become available whether it's done in the UK where they've got the green light or wherever.
Okay.
What we're talking about now is how fast we can get this in the clinic. So that you're not going to stop that technology from getting out there. So the only decision you really have to make here is do you want to get this into the clinic sooner rather than later and help people?
Okay, talking about helping people, I wanted you to address this issue. The people who are going to be putting up the venture capital here, the people
mm-hmm.
who are going to be the taxpayers of California,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be borrowing $3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to cost them $6 billion to pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
And the money through the Institute for Regenerative Medicine will be going to the contractors and the construction people
mm-hmm.
and the researchers, including universities,
mm-hmm.
biotech companies.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to own the knowledge that's being created that way? And what do you know from your own experience there between investors and nonprofits
right.
and your own operations and
Well, what I would suspect is whether you're in private industry or whether you're at a university, and little known fact is that researchers at all the universities aggressively are pursuing patents as well.
Right.
So in the case of the California ballot, this initiative, this is going to be carried out in California.
Right.
So all the intellectual property rights are going to belong to either your state universities or the universities that are carrying out the work.
Right.
And so what you basically have is what is a remarkable thing here is you're at a very early stage of a very, very important technology, and all the discoveries, all the breakthroughs are going to be happening in the next few years, and California would essentially have a monopoly and own the future of this.
Will your company move to California to get some of the money and get
the
knowledge?
Company already is planning to set up a headquarters out there. Yes,
okay.
It will be on both coasts.
So you'd be completely eligible. Harvard and Stanford will be represented in the operations then.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that, I think that what you will find here is a brain drain from not only the rest of the country but the rest of the world to California. You will end up, like I said, being the intellectual center here for this work.
I'm saying, though, let's say money goes to Stanford in Palo Alto, it goes to Jaron in Menlo Park. They do different things. They get this intellectual property. The people of California will have put up the money, and the stockholders of Jaron and the trustees of Stanford will own the rights to the knowledge that will be used. Is that the way it's traditionally done? Don't investors usually get a share in the fruits of their investment?
Well, the investors, if I understand this correct, will be the taxpayers, correct?
Yes, the taxpayers are paying.
So what would happen is I presume the way this would play out, I mean, I'm not in California,
right.
But I would presume the money would be going off to UC Berkeley, UCLA, Stanford, you know, most of the brightest and most creative people in the country are at those universities.
Certainly.
So the money will be going there.
Right.
And those institutes will have the licenses, and those people will be rewarded, so the state economy would basically reap the benefit. It doesn't mean they'll have a monopoly on it, but they will have the lion's share. So my guess would be the work being done in California, the lion's share of that would stay with California universities and institutions, and so the employment there and the industry would build up there.
Well, yeah, but when you have investors there at ACT, right?
And
they buy stock and so on, and then when you make a discovery and make money, then they get appreciation of the stock, and they get dividends and so on.
Right.
When the people of California loan $3 billion to the borrow mm-hmm. in the time of economic the state's already borrowing $10 billion or so to pay its unbalanced budget, borrows that money and then gives it to the corporations and the universities and the research institutes to do this research, then they do the research, and then the rights to those findings that have been paid for by the taxpayers adhere to the universities and the private companies, not to the taxpayers.
I'm a scientist. I'm not a businessman, but I wouldn't look at it that way at all. I mean,
okay.
I would think that this would be a very wise investment in the state university, in the education system. If UCLA and UC Berkeley and Stanford and these universities that are all California-based and they're educating California citizens and, if they're making money from this, that's less that the state's gonna have to pay to run the universities. I mean, I understand that it requires a substantial amount of money to run these public institutions. And if they're making money through licensing all this technology, it's all California.
Okay.
Unless I'm missing something here.
Okay. One or two more things, and then I'll let you get back to the lab.
Okay.
The argument is made by the proponents of Proposition 71 that it's a good idea because it will drastically reduce healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm only an informal observer of healthcare cost trends, but it seems that the more high-tech things get, the more expensive they get. And I'm wondering what your take is on whether or not these methods, as they're pioneered and developed and rolled out, will reduce or raise the cost of healthcare.
Well, I think that there are some applications that would be very expensive and some that wouldn't. So I think that to have a custom therapy such as nuclear transplantation, this could be quite expensive to do that for every patient. On the other hand, I do believe, you know, when you start talking about something like diabetes, it costs the, you know, the U.S. economy $100 billion a year,
$100 billion a year.
And $100 billion, again, for Alzheimer's disease. We're talking about very substantial amounts of money, and we're talking about a cell therapy. You're talking about a generic cell type. If we had, you know, a few dozen lines that could be used for everyone, and, you know, we can grow them up by the millions or billions in a Petri dish very easily, once those were established, this would be relatively inexpensive. I mean, I don't know if you have any idea how much it is, you know, to put a, you know, up for a patient to be on dialysis or to, you know, to have a heart or a kidney or a liver transplant. These are very expensive procedures. I think that once you have the cells, they can be grown with a little meteor, and, you know, and they'd be inexpensive when you start applying this to very large numbers of patients. So I think that, you know, the initial cost is what it is, and then the subsequent application of it will be very much reduced, and again, it will, you know, a lot will depend on the particular disease application and how much effort is required for that. But again, many of these cell therapies are going to be very simple. For instance, when we fixed the heart attacks that occurred in these mice, it was just a simple injection of a tiny number of cells, and like I said, in a few weeks, we restored 40% of the damaged heart. I mean, that would be a relatively inexpensive procedure, certainly a lot cheaper than having somebody, you know, going through congestive heart failure and, you know, and all the subsequent problems that start occurring, you know.
So in fact, once you've solved the problem, you can essentially reproduce the treatment.
You just grow the cells. That's all you got to do.
As easily as growing on trees, practically.
Yeah, easier in many instances.
Okay, why don't you close by doing this. Tell me what your vision is of, if this all works out, how broad spread and how effective can these therapies be, say, within 5 years, and what's that going to mean for Alzheimer's, for diabetes, for Parkinson's, and multiple sclerosis?
Well, you know, I don't know about 5 years, but what I would say is if you're around my age, within our lifetime, what this will mean, and I don't think this is science fiction, I think this is very real, you know, you'll go to the doctor, if you say you get in an accident and lose your kidney, you know, you'll go and you'll get a skin cell and just grow you up a new kidney. I really think that the advances being done in stem cells and also in the field known as tissue engineering to reconstitute more complex tissues and structures are happening at such a rapid pace that I would say in the next 10 or 15 years, we're going to have the ability to really substantially change the course of most of these major diseases.
And overall, or in all ways, you think then that Proposition 71 is a good idea in order to speed that process up?
Brilliant. I think what you're doing out there in California is unbelievable, and all the power to you.
Okay, well, thanks. What you're doing there in Massachusetts is pretty good, too. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much for talking to us on California Politics today.
Sure, okay.
Bye.
Have a good day.
You
Bye.
Too. Bye.
Bye.